This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If asked to imagine a medieval city, you probably think of Europe or the Middle East. Walled fiefdoms, bustling market stalls, maybe a castle or cathedral or dome of a mosque. You won't likely conjure up pyramids on the floodplains of the Mississippi River, though that is the site of a complex metropolis that was home to as many as 30,000 people in the year 1050, bigger than contemporary Paris or London. By 1400, the population had disappeared, and today archaeologists don't even know what it's called, but use the name Cahokia after the tribe that occupied the city in the 17th century when European explorers rolled through town. So what happened? Annalee Newitz is founder of IO9, former editor-in-chief of Gizmodo, and tech culture editor for Ars Technica. She joined a team of archaeologists digging to find answers about the lost city. Annalee, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I had no idea this even existed. Where exactly is the site?
So it's in southern Illinois, and the main part of the site is in a town called Collinsville, and that's east of East St. Louis. So basically, to get there, you kind of drive through the suburbs and find yourself in a beautiful park.
Well, that's the thing. The land was developed there for farms, you know, built over throughout development. So how much of it was lost?
So it's hard to say for sure how much of the city hasn't been found yet, because every time there's a major freeway project or breaking ground somewhere, especially in East St. Louis, we tend to find more evidence that the city stretched further than we knew. So right now, there's a rather large site that's a UNESCO World Heritage Site in Collinsville. So you can go visit, and there's a visitor's center where you can learn all about the people who lived in Cahokia. But that's just that area that you can visit and you can walk around in is really just the downtown part of the city, where they had a huge central pyramid that today we call Monk's Mound, because some French monks used to live there about 200 years ago. But before that, of course, long ago, about 1,000 years ago, that probably would have been a site where elites in the city would do rituals or might have spoken to the people of the city about new ideas. And so you can visit the downtown, and then all of the rest of the town is kind of underneath East St. Louis, and parts of it are also underneath St. Louis as well.
So you went out and joined the dig yourself with several researchers. And you're talking about the layout of a city that sort of suggests hierarchy and division and centralization. What else do we know about this place that was home to more than 30,000 people, more than London or Paris at the time? So when was it inhabited?
So the area was inhabited continuously for many thousands of years, but it really was just small villages. And then sometime around the year 1000, a new group of people came into the area and started to build mounds. And in fact, there are mound cities throughout the United States, especially in the South and parts of the Midwest. And if you've lived in one of those places, you might have heard of a place called Moundville or Mound City. There's a lot of those. And so this group of people had seen those other mound cities and decided, okay, we're going to build the greatest mound city of all. And it certainly is. I mean, the mounds are enormous. There's dozens of them, and they kind of form a complex pattern. If you can look at the city above, you can sort of see that there's a northwest orientation to the layout of the mounds that's very striking. And what we know is that they probably built the city pretty quickly, that these huge mounds may have been built just on the order of decades, and it was probably a kind of religious revival that inspired the creation of the city. And there's a lot of evidence for that, both from contemporary Native American culture, but also from the kinds of symbols that we find buried there. And was it a religious revival? Was it a kind of political revival? These are the kinds of questions that archaeologists want to answer, but really we need a time machine to know, but it seems clear that what brought people together was a new way of thinking and a new way of organizing their culture. It wasn't like they came together to build cars or to make statues or to trade things. It really wasn't an economic entity so much as it was a kind of spiritual city or political city.
Well, there is a map with some artist renderings accompanying your article, which I would really encourage people to look at. And we'll have all that posted at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, but how about the things that we do know? What did get uncovered that reveals what the culture there was like?
So we know for sure that these people were farmers, and they were incredibly talented farmers. And this is at a time when, you know, the kinds of farms that you would typically see in Europe would have just been little tiny family plots. And these, the people of Cahokia had vast farms, and they were farming a number of different kinds of, they had maize, but they also had a lot of other starchy seeds. So they were very organized in terms of providing food for all the people that lived there. They were fantastic architects. They knew how to take mud and turn it into these enduring structures that we still have today, these mounds. And they also had religious beliefs that had to do with an upper world and an underworld coming together. And there's a lot of imagery in the pots that they left behind and in figurines that we found that show that people really valued the idea of the upper world, which was full of spirits and thunder and, you know, the land of the sky, and the underworld coming together. The underworld was the land of farming and earth and fish and sea. And so we think of the underworld in the West as being kind of like where demons are. It's like a terrible place. But the underworld for Cahokians was the place of fertility. It was where you grew things and where all of the food was. And so when the upper world and underworld came together, it was very powerful. So there's some hints that maybe part of the reason why people created these mounds, nobody really lived on top of them except for maybe a few elites perhaps, but it was a way of symbolizing the underworld and the upper world coming together in this very special, powerful way. And Cahokia was in an area that was very, very fertile. The land around the city would have been incredibly great for farming. And so it must have seemed to those people like, wow, we've come to this amazing place where stuff just grows like crazy. This must be a kind of blessed place or really special in some way.
Right. With the Mississippi floodplain, the soil would be rich there. But also a lot of evidence of having a sense of the artistic or the decorative. What did you find in that realm?
So there's a lot of, there's a type of pottery called Raimi that comes from Cahokia and actually was so beautiful. It's these really finely made pots that are often covered in a black slip or like a black paint. And then they're carved into them are all of these beautiful images of the underworld and the upper world. You'll see fish, but you'll also see abstract patterns that are just beautiful. And these were so valued, these Raimi pots, that people who visited Cahokia carried them as far as Florida. People would come from far away to visit Cahokia for feasts and then would leave and bring trinkets with them. There's also art of what often gets called a birdman or a hawkman. And it's basically just a person with kind of a hooked nose and wings. And that figure appears throughout the Mississippian area as well during the medieval period. And so we think maybe that was a superhero figure or some kind of, you know, mythical figure, possibly related to contemporary Sioux stories about Red Horn, who is a really awesome superhero who hung out with the gods. But we don't know who that was. We just call him the Birdman. And then, of course, there were all kinds of other pieces of artistic expression that kind of don't really survive because a lot of what they built with was wood. And so we have some hints of how much they might have decorated that wood and what they would have done with it. But mostly we just have post holes. So we can see that they built this thing that's called Woodhenge, which is just like Stonehenge, but with big wood poles for measuring the solstice. And we figure that those poles were probably decorated in some way, not like a totem pole, which is more of a West Coast style, but maybe covered in, you know, different kinds of baskets or painted in some way. I mean, it's interesting because the city really was built out of perishable material. And so what we look at are the layouts of the houses and kind of the burned remains of their offerings to the gods.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Continuing my conversation with Annalee Newitz. She's founder of IO9 and editor for Ars Technica. And she joined in an archaeological dig exploring the site of a bustling city larger than contemporary London or Paris in the year 1050. But this place, Cahokia, was not in the Middle East or Europe, but in what is now southern Illinois near St. Louis. Before the break, Annalee was telling us about the flourishing artistic and cultural life of the city called Cahokia before it was abandoned around 1400. So what do archaeologists speculate led to the city's decline less than 300 years after it was home to some 30,000 people?
It's the biggest mystery about the city, and it's what is so fascinating to me and the archaeologists who work on it. Why did people abandon this incredible city that had so many resources? And there are a number of theories or a number of hypotheses, and there's one that's pretty simple, which is that, you know, climate change affected their ability to feed everyone in the city. And there is evidence that there may have been droughts that would have really affected the crops. So that was probably going on for sure. But on top of that problem, it seems that there was some kind of violent political transformation late in the life of the city, where people had basically changed their relationship to the downtown area of the city. So Monk's Mound, the huge earthen pyramid that was at the center of the city, was at one time in the middle of a big open plaza, and it's assumed that people came to that plaza and had big public ceremonies and hung out and met their leaders, or at least saw their leaders at the top of the mound. But then late in the city's life, a huge fence is built around Monk's Mound and around some of the houses that presumably were next to it. And so it's as if the people who were the elites living on Monk's Mound were kind of worried that people might be coming to get them. So it's possible that that was a defensive perimeter because people in the city were starting to get pissed off at the people on the mound. And again, this is, you know, a hypothesis. We don't know for sure because there was no writing left behind. But what we do know is that after that fence was built, within a couple of decades, people stopped using Monk's Mound. In fact, they started throwing garbage into the area around Monk's Mound inside that fenced-in area, which again suggests that people may have been rejecting whatever that mound had represented. And about half the population of the city just kind of leaves around that point. So something happened. There was some change in the relationship with power in the city. And we also, at that point, see Woodhenge torn down and an end to the human sacrifices that we believe happened early in the city's life. We have lots of evidence of human sacrifice, and it just completely stops at the point when people start to leave the city. So something changed, probably some kind of political shift, and then the city just slowly emptied out over the next century.
Well, I'm going to hone in on that human sacrifice, because there are other Central and South American people thought to have used ritualistic human sacrifice, like the Aztecs. But some historians have been skeptical of that and dismissed what were primarily European accounts of human sacrifice, you know, as antiquated or a stereotype. What's the evidence of human sacrifice in Cahokia?
So one thing I would point out is that we know that Europeans engaged in human sacrifice right around the same time that the Cahokians did. We had things like public executions, there were crusades. So this is kind of a medieval thing that happens both in Europe and in the Americas. So the evidence that we have is from a mound that was opened up in the 1960s, and this was before the rules that were put in place where Native Americans needed to be notified that their ancestors were being dug up and that it needed to be done under the supervision of Native American groups. And so this kind of thing would not happen now, but it did happen in the 60s. And so what was discovered were several mass graves, one of which had 54 young women in it, and they appeared to have been, you know, killed all at the same time and laid out in a very beautiful, orderly way, along with a lot of other sacrificial items and gifts. There's also a famous burial right next to it in the same mound called the Birdman Burial, which was also some kind of theatrical sacrifice of a young man and a young woman, probably in a fertility ritual of some kind. And they're buried with tons of beads and weapon points and different kinds of very valuable items. So these were not prisoners that were being chucked away. These were people who were part of a sacrifice where, and, you know, a sacrifice is where you give up things that you love and value to the gods. And so these were people who'd been sacrificed along with valued objects, which were buried in this mound. And so, again, without a time machine, we can't be sure what happened and how they were sacrificed and why. But we do know from chemical analysis of the bones in the teeth of the skeletons that most of these sacrifices were people who were local to the area, so probably from Cahokia or nearby towns. So it wasn't like they were enemies that were from far away. And again, you know, there are many communities in South America and Central America and North America where there were human sacrifice rituals, and this was just part of worshiping. And it would not have been considered horrific until maybe it was. And that's one of the questions that we have, is maybe if at the end of the life of the city, people started to say, hey, you know, the elites in the city are making us give up our daughters for sacrifice or give up our sons for sacrifice. And, you know, what the hell's going on with that? So there may have been a shift in feeling about how fair it was or how worshipful it was to do this. But we don't know that for sure. So it's just one idea among many. But we, I think archaeologists are pretty satisfied that these were definitely human sacrifices.
Wow, so fascinating, this cosmology, all of these theories, but they are theories, but pretty well developed. So why do we not hear about this Cahokia city like we've heard of sites uncovered in, you know, caves in France or sites in Egypt or in Greece?
Well, that's another mystery. I think, you know, people really need to learn more about it. And this site was only turned into a World Heritage Site in the 1980s. So compared to some of these other sites in Europe, it's a relatively young site, but it's quite lovely. And it is true that school children in the St. Louis area all go visit it. But I've gotten a lot of emails since writing the article from people who grew up in the area saying, wow, they made us visit this as kids, but I had no idea that it was so cool. So I think that, you know, the more that people do go out and learn about it, I think the more they'll appreciate the greatness of Native American culture in this country and how basically when Europeans arrived, this country had been urban for a really long time. And we'd had a lot of great metropolises that were all across the country. And this was the biggest in the place that became the United States. But it's just one of many cities that Native Americans built and that the ancestors of today's Native Americans were constructing. And so it's just, I hope that this kind of history will really awaken people to understanding how cool it's been in this country for a really long time. And not just cool, but sophisticated and very well-developed civilization.
Annalee Newitz, she's founder of IO9 and tech culture editor for Ars Technica. That's where we found her story of joining a team of archaeologists to find answers about the lost city of Cahokia. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find a link to read the article and take a look at the renderings of Cahokia. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.